Have you ever thought about that while you're away, your home could be an Airbnb? I did. I actually bought two homes in Albuquerque that I Airbnb'd, and it was just an amazing investment, honestly, because, you know, as you are accruing value in your property, you are also making money on the Airbnbs. It's amazing. So your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
21 Seeds infused tequila is a must-have. It's an award-winning tequila. It's infused with real juice, with real fruit, which means the flavors are built in. It's real. So you need like two or three ingredients to make your perfect cocktail. Hey, you know how I'm always trying to keep my house parties exciting? New cocktails? Do you?
Yeah.
Okay, well, here's something that's going to flip the script.
Okay.
All right, 21 Seeds infused tequila.
Yeah. Tell me more about this, right? Oliver Hudson.
Yeah, 21 Seeds is an award-winning tequila that's infused with juice from real fruits. You only need two to three ingredients to make the perfect cocktail.
Wait a minute. I think I know what brand you're talking about. You know why?
Yeah.
Because 21 Seeds is founded by two sisters and their friend. It's female founded.
That's right.
See?
Sounds
See
like
how I know? Something I can get behind.
I know. Well, there's a good story behind that for sure. Listen, if you love tequila, you have to try 21 Seeds infused tequila. Enjoy responsibly. 21 Seeds, Diageo, New York, New York.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Hi, I'm Kate Hudson.
And my name is Oliver Hudson.
We wanted to do something that highlighted our relationship.
And what it's like to be siblings.
We are a sibling rivalry.
No, no.
Sibling rivalry.
Don't do that with your mouth.
Sibling rivalry.
That's good.
Ollie, I'm so excited about this because I love this man. Like, I'm kind of obsessed with him.
I know. I've never met this man.
I have.
Oh, you have?
And I'm going to save it for the podcast. Tony Robbins is one of my favorite motivational speakers, sort of, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like he just exudes everything positive and motivating and, like, just an absolute force of nature.
Yeah.
I've never been to one of his seminars,
neither
but a lot of my friends have been, and they say it's life-changing.
We need to go. I need to go. Maybe I can just use this as a private seminar.
Yeah.
But you know what I love about Tony Robbins too, and I have not met him? He can take the piss out of himself as well.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, he's definitely...
Yeah, he's got a sense of humor about all of his stuff.
Right.
You know, which
right.
I love.
His newest book is The Holy Grail of Investing.
Mm-hmm.
I want to delve into this. Amazon, it was for a bit.
Yeah.
But I want to get into that a little bit with him. I read a little bit about it. I have not read the book yet. Have you read the book?
No, I don't read about investing. I just
you don't want to jinx
I
it.
I just throw my money where people tell me to without any reconnaissance. Yeah,
let's unpack that with Tony. We're gonna unpack that with
half
Tony.
Of the time let's the founders end up in jail.
Can we let him in?
Because
he's waiting. He's like the one person
I never want to wait. Let's go.
All right, let's bring Tony in. Hi, handsome.
How are you? Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
What's going on?
Actually, I was just saying this in our introduction, Tony. I have met you before.
Yeah.
And I will never forget it because I was a little girl and it was the Kings, the Los Angeles Kings were in the playoffs.
I might have been there.
And we were back in the hallway. I was with my mom and my dad. We were waiting to go into the locker room. And it was our family and you were standing there and I got to meet you and I will never forget it because you're so tall And I couldn't believe how big you were. And I could, and obviously, as everyone knows, you just exude such positive energy. So you left a mark on me as a young child. Mm-hmm. I have met.
Well, I don't know your father, but I love your mom, and I've met her a few times and had some nice conversations with her. I hope she's doing well.
She is. She's doing great.
Well, let's start simple. What is your net worth?
Welcome to our podcast, Tony. Well, look, I feel like everybody in the world knows who you are. For those who don't, you are a
There's no reason to even give your bio. Turn it off.
Yeah.
Turn the podcast off. But I'd honestly like to know about your upbringing, your childhood, where you were born, how you grew up, how you what were the seeds, you know, to actually becoming who you are.
Yeah, I was born in downtown Los Angeles, believe it or not, and I grew up in the San Gabriel Valley, east of LA, and kind of where we had smog alerts each day, so you couldn't go outside during those days. So I'm happy with the clean air you now have there. Although I don't live in LA anymore. But I grew up in a kind of a tough environment. I had four different fathers. My mom was a very intense lady, shaped me immensely. I love her and adore her. She's passed away. But she also abused, unfortunately, prescription drugs and alcohol. And when she did, she got a little violent. So I really became a practical psychologist to protect my younger brother and younger sister. I had to learn how to change her states. I had to anticipate what was going on. That's where it began for me. And then I was also just, the difference in our lives made me want to know the difference in people. Like, why do people's lives turn out a certain way? And I didn't have any mentors. So I took a speed reading class and I promised myself I'd read a book a day, but you know, I didn't do that. But I read 700 books in 7 years in the area of human development, psychology, physiology, philosophy, anything I thought could make a difference. And then when I was 11 years old, we had no money and no food at Thanksgiving. And it's probably the most profound experience of my life because, you know, all my fathers had talked about, you know, no one cares about anybody else. And, you know, we're in it by ourselves and we're on the other side of the tracks and all those stories, which kind of felt true in the environment I grew up in. But someone delivered food to our house on Thanksgiving. I don't just mean food. There was a knock on the door and I answered the door as this guy with two giant bags of groceries and a empty frozen turkey on the ground in a pot and said, "Is your father here?" And I mean, we wouldn't have starved. We would have had crackers and peanut butter. But on Thanksgiving, you know, it's magnified when you don't have a big meal when everybody else does. And it changed my life because it wasn't the food that changed my life. It's like I pulled from that strangers care. And if strangers care about me, I want to care about strangers. And it, you know, left an indelible mark. When I was 17, I fed two families and then four and then eight. And as years got by, I got to 1 million people. And then about 8 years ago, I was writing this book called Money Master the Game, where I interviewed 50 of the, you know, most successful investors in history, the, you know, Ray Dalios, Carl Icahns, Warren Buffetts, and you know, they're all multi-billionaires. And I saw that Congress cut food stamps, they now call it the SNAP program, by $6 billion. So every family that actually needs food would have to give up a week's worth of food every month unless people like us step in. And so I called my team and said, how many people have I fed in my lifetime? I'd never kept track. And it was 42 million people. So I was really proud of it. What if I did 50 million in a year, did as much as I did in my whole life in a year? And then I'm like, what if I did 100 million a year? What if I did 100 million a year for 10 years and fed 1 billion meals? I'm proud to tell you, I did it in 8 years. We finished it last year. And now I'm doing a 100 billion meal challenge. But all of those things helped to shape who I was. And then I went to a seminar. I never heard of a seminar. I was working for this man on the weekends. I was still in junior high school and I was moving things for him. And I was a tough worker. And my parents, my father had said, you know, that guy used to be such a loser. And now he's so successful. How come? And so he took me to lunch and he said, you know, you're such a hard worker. You know, I want to talk to you a little bit. And I said, you might have asked some questions. And I, you know, I wasn't being harsh. I didn't realize what I was saying. I said, my dad said you used to be such a loser. And I said, what? You know, but he goes, I guess it's true. And he said, I went to this seminar. And I said, what's a seminar? And he said, this man takes decades of his life and pours into 4 or 5 hours and teaches you the best of what he's learned and save you a few decades. And I was like, I'd like to do that. Could you get me in? He said, sure. And then he didn't say any more. So I said, will you? And he said, no. And I said, well, why not? And he said, because if you don't invest in it, you won't value it. So I said, how much is it? And this is 1977, right? So he says it's $35. It'd be like $250 today in US and with inflation. And I was making $40 a week as a janitor, right? So it's like, to me, it was the biggest decision of my life. But I made this decision. I went to the seminar. I listened to this man speak, and I was on fire. And I eventually went to work for him and learned to speak and do things and expand. And I learned skills on how to turn people around very quickly using some various tools of neurolinguistic programming and Ericksonian work. And then I started working with sports teams and Mother Teresa and Nelson Mandela, the presidents, and it just grew and grew and grew. And now,
Tony, was that Jim Rohn, Jim Rohn? And what was it about him that really like stuck with you? Like that the first light bulb.
Right. And did you model your style after him?
Well, no, our styles are radically different, but I have enormous respect. I mean, I can do his style, but it's not me.
Right.
He's much slower tempo, and he's a philosopher. I love philosophy and strategy. But what got me with him were some simple philosophies like, you know, for things to change, you got to change. For things to get better, you got to get better, you know? And that probably the greatest gift he gave me was I went to him and I said, you know, I have four fathers. They're all good people. How come, you know, we don't have any money? How come we didn't have any food, you know? And I was lamenting about how, you know, these teachers only make, I think it was $35,000 back then. And this hedge fund guy made $1 billion and how unfair it is. And he said, Tony, well, let me give you a little lesson. He said, we're all equal as souls, but we're not equal in the marketplace. Mm-hmm. I said, what does that mean? And he said, well, you have to become more valuable in order to be able to earn more. And he said, so let's start with McDonald's. He said, nothing wrong with McDonald's, but those basic jobs at McDonald's where people get minimum pay, there's a reason. It's because anyone can do that job. Anyone can learn it in a few hours. So you don't get much for it. But he said, your school teachers, you know, if they were willing to be paid for performance, they could earn a lot more. But he said, of all your school teachers, I'm sure you said some great ones, how many were great? And I named two or three. And he goes, out of all your teachers, he said, and they only work with 35 people, right? He said, you know, this hedge fund guy, people in those days were getting like 6%, not, mm-hmm. you know, the recent years, what used to be 3 and 2 and 3. And he said, you know, he got 48% returns for the last 3 years. And those are people's pensions. That's their kids going to college. That's all those things. So he's worth it. He said, so here's what you need to do. Instead of comparing yourself to other people, he said, find a way every day to become more. You need to become more valuable in the marketplace. Figure out what skills, what abilities you're passionate about. And he said, your entire focus has got to be on adding more value. Do more for other people than anybody else in your category over and over again, and you'll build a brand and you'll never have to worry about anything in your life and you'll enjoy your life. And so that's been a guiding principle. And I have 114 companies now, and we do over $7 billion in business in all these different industries I'm a part of. And I have no business background, but the one thing that is the base of all those is I'm obsessed with doing more for others than anybody else in the category. And when you do that over and over again, those companies, you know, grow. So that philosophy shaped my life.
What about going back to the four fathers? Yeah. Like, how did that work? By the way, the four fathers, there's a word play in there for something. Like, I don't know if your next book wanted to be called My Four Fathers and sort of play on that.
Ollie wants a cuddle.
You can have,
right?
No, you so. Can have it. You can have it. just
Tony,
tell me where to invest.
Say, Ollie, that's not a good.
Tell me where to invest. But as far as that went for you, it's an interest. I'm just the dynamic of that, saying that they're all great men. Did they all have an influence on you one way or another? Were they all in your life? Like, how did that, because you speak as them if it's like an entity.
Well, yeah, no, it's just because they weren't all at once. They were all at once, but individually they were her husbands, you know? So my natural father was a parking attendant in downtown Los Angeles. And he was not a bad man. He was an alcoholic, but not a mean alcoholic. He didn't beat me up or anything like that. He just went in his own world. And, you know, if you can imagine just being underground, taking people's tickets all day long, that now, you know, a machine does, that was him for 40 years. Hmm. And so I think a lot of what I did not want to become was based on my mom's view of him and then leaving him. So I was like, I'm not going to be that way. But he was a good man. My second father, Art, was his uncle or his cousin. So my mom kept it in the family for a little bit. and he was more of an artistic type and a mechanic and very different, but didn't have much impact on me other than physical discipline, mm-hmm. you know, spankings, that kind of stuff. And then the one that influenced me the most, there was Bob, who was very brief. My mom was married to him before I was born, and then he would enter in and out of our life. He was somebody that I found aspirational. He owned his own gym. He learned to fly a small airplane. He was a really nice guy. But the one who affected me most was Jim Robbins, and he adopted me, and he was mm-hmm. my fourth father. And he was a former semi-pro baseball player. He looked kind of like Tom Jones when Tom Jones was very popular. We had a crappy house, no money for food, but he had a brand new Cadillac convertible. So you get the idea.
I can relate.
I earned his love through sports, and I always wanted to play sports. My mom, we didn't have any money, and my mom didn't want me to get hurt because I was so small, believe it or not. I was 5'1 in high school, and I'm 6'7 now. So wow. I tell people, difference is personal growth, of course.
Right. Do you have like siblings?
So yeah, I have a younger brother, 5 years younger, younger sister, 7 years younger. So we, you know, I kind of was the father of the family, so to speak, because as husbands left, I took the responsibility each time. So it helped me grow, and I'm grateful for it.
Yeah, no, I know. I mean, that sort of doesn't sound, I mean, I'm sure there was hardship, obviously, but it's sort of the basis of sort of, I guess what you're teaching is how to sort of get through these hardships, how to not let them stop you, you know, because I'm sure you're well read. I don't know if you're an actual psychologist, but how much does psychology come into play when you are giving these motivational speeches or these seminars? Because some people are just stuck no matter what the hell they hear.
Really tools. I mean, I think the thing that separates Tony from a lot of motivational speakers is the access to actual strategy and tools.
I've never seen myself as a motivator. When people see an audience of, you know, 15,000 people in the stadium and they're jumping and so forth, that's what they get in their head. But it's just creating energy because you know what it'd be like. Most people won't sit for a 3-hour movie someone spent $300 million for, and I take people 12 hours a day, 5 days or 7 days. Some got dragged there initially. And in order to get them that, you have to make time disappear. You have to make it so enjoyable while they're transforming and so impactful that, you know, hours go by and it feels like minutes. You know, when you hate what you're experiencing, a minute feels like eternity. Time's emotion, right? So, mine is more, it's more strategy, and the strategies give people very specific results. And so that's how I built my career. I built my career by challenging psychiatrists and psychologists to say, give me your worst patient and I'll have it right here, right now. I'll wipe this problem out in 15 minutes to 30 minutes. And I started in Canada in Vancouver, and I got on this radio show and I launched like this. And this one psychiatrist made my entire career because he got on and attacked me, and I never met me. And you're a liar, you're a charlatan, people like you shouldn't be allowed on the radio. And my response was, well, sir, have you ever met me? No. Have you ever met my clients? No. Well, I said, are you a scientist? Yes, of course, I'm a physician. I said, well, I know a scientist would never assume such a thing, so you must be stating your hypothesis. So let's test it. We're doing a free event at the Holiday Inn tomorrow night, 7:00. Anyone listening can come. And I said, I suggest you bring me one of your patients. Bring me somebody you've never been able to cure. I'm sure you have plenty of those because you want to be tough. I can be tough right back. And I was playful. And the guy said, we all have people who aren't ready to change yet. And I said, that's funny. I haven't found any. Of course, I've only done 4 therapies at that point in my whole life. But it created this drama. And in those days, it was the beginning of my career, I'd get like 50 people to show up for a free guest event. Well, 500 people showed up to see the shootout at OK Corral between me and this psychiatrist. Mm-hmm. And then, do you guys do this? Before you meet somebody, if you meet them on the phone, you haven't met them in person, I don't know. I always make a picture of what they look like.
100%, yeah.
So this guy's like, okay, I'll be there. So I'm picturing this huge guy with a scared woman on his arm. And I'm looking around the room. And in those days, I don't have a big staff or anything. I'm introducing myself. So nobody matched the picture. The room is so packed that the fire department comes in, they'll shut me down. People are standing along the walls. And so I said, I'm Tony Robbins. I'm here to show you ways to change in minutes that you might think take months or years. Without hyperbole, I'm going to do some demonstrations. And then the side door bursts open like a movie. And this 5'1" guy comes walking. And he stands right in front of me while I'm speaking to the audience. And I turn to the audience and I say, it looks like I have a visitor. And I go to shake his hand. And he wouldn't even shake my hand. He goes, here's the woman. So I took this woman. She had a snake phobia, which if you've ever seen a phobia, it's an uncontrollable response to a stimulus. Well, she would go to sleep at night and she'd have a dream that a snake would bite her on the face and her adrenaline would push through her body and she'd wake up 4 or 5 times a night. He'd been treating her 7 years. So I said, oh, that should take me 10 or 15 minutes, right? So it took me about 20. At first, I showed how dramatic it was. I was saying about snakes, and she started freaking out and spitting and shaking. I calmed her down. And then at the end of it, I reached back and yelled snake. She had no reaction. I said, wow, what a difference. And then I went behind her, and I had this table back here, and I pulled this bag, and the bag's moving, and the audience is seeing it. Just a little gardener snake. I pick up the snake and put it in front of her. And she did pull back, but she didn't scream or shake or spit. And I was like, ma'am, how do you feel about snakes? And she goes, they're not very attractive. Or you couldn't even think of a snake without going crazy. Now it's right here in front of you. I said, How'd you like to hold it? She goes, it's not very attractive. And the audience starts going, hold it, hold it, hold it. So she grabs the snake, starts to squeeze it. I said, don't kill it. And that really began my career.
Presented by 21 Seeds.
Ollie.
Yeah. So, you know, because you have a ton of friends and you throw a lot of parties.
Yeah.
You don't really. I mean, you've got your core group of friends.
I do throw a lot of
you
parties.
You do throw a lot of parties.
I love a party.
You need a signature cocktail that's ready to go.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, it's also actually nice to have a signature cocktail that's ready to go when you don't have a bartender.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's just nice to have something in your fridge and you get home from work and you just want a drink.
This is true.
But you know why I like this brand of tequila?
Let me guess. Can I guess?
Yes.
Female founded.
Yes. I love a female founded spirit because there aren't that many of us.
I know. And 21 Seeds makes the most delicious and easiest margaritas ever. They're smooth. They're fresh. They taste amazing. And they're not too sweet.
No.
I do not like sweet.
They're not overly sweet.
Yeah. And they're infused with real juice.
Yes. I love women. I love supporting women. So.
Two sisters, one friend.
Listen, if you love tequila, add 21 Seeds infused tequila to your drink bar at home.
Enjoy responsibly. 21 Seeds, Diageo, New York, New York.
It's a fun time of year because everybody's starting to gear up. You've got spring break happening soon. You've got summer happening soon. Everybody's thinking about their vacations. My number one source for where I might even go in the world, Airbnb. I've got spring break. I'm shooting. I only have 4 days. Where am I going to go? I go on Airbnb and that usually is like, oh, there's a good house. I love that. Let's stay there. If you are someone who travels a lot or even has an empty room in your house, consider hosting on Airbnb. It's a lot easier than you might think, and it's also a great way to make some extra income. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Tony, what do you think in all of your experience, you worked with so many people, like what is the attachment to these types of fears or phobias? Like, what is the breakthrough to get through those things that you find? Because we can sit and unpack everything for
Are you talking about specifically like flying and this
yeah, like phobias? Flying, fear, self-worth, like all those, so those things that are holding you back. Like, you know, like he said, give me 20 minutes, give me an hour, you know, and we can see the shifts. Like, what do you think it is in our brain that makes us hold on to these thoughts that we've created for ourselves?
That's right. And there's no way in 20 minutes you could make me feel good about myself. It's not possible. My lack of self-love and self-worth is fucking strong. I went to the Hoffman Institute and they cracked me for a minute. You know what I mean? But
Sounds like it's your trophy hanging on to that.
That's right. Exactly. <Yeah. laughs> That's the narrative that I've created.
Well, the answer to your question, in my experience, is, you know, our brains they're 2 million years old and they've evolved slowly. And there's a survival part of our brain, which is what most people run their life on. And the survival part is always looking for what can harm you. And it was designed to look for a saber-toothed tiger so you could fight or you could flight, you could run or freeze and hopefully not be seen. But today people have that same reaction to what somebody wrote about them in social media, or whether they have enough money or not. And, you know, even those that are poor in this country, and I help those people, obviously, I have about 100 million meals each year, do a lot of other things. But honestly, you know, in this country, poor is very different than poor in India or somewhere else. I mean, you really, it's not the same. So those survival instincts take over. And so what you have to do is you have to get people out of the survival mechanism and get into their consciousness and show them how they can condition themselves to make that change quickly when the fear shows up. A lot of it is conditioning. You know, it's like one-time learning. Something happened, freaked you out in that moment, and you saw the bridge, and now bridges freak you out every time you think of it. And so that's why one-time interventions can also do the same thing. And most people don't believe that. But the good news is I've been doing it, you know, for this is my 47th year. And I, you know, I did this documentary a few years, about a decade ago on Netflix called Tony Robbins, I'm Not Your Guru. And, you know, we did follow up on those people 10 years later. And now I've trained therapists all over the world. And we have hundreds of these interventions that we've done where you can see what I did in real time. I didn't know what they're going to do. And then you get to see them 3 years later, 5 years later, and see that the change is lasting.
Do you ever get burnt out?
Well, sure. Physically, I get burnt out. I don't get burnt out emotionally because I love what I do and I love people. I love my family. It's pretty hard. You know, all I got to do is wake up and walk down the street. And it's just like you. I mean, you get stopped, I'm sure, every day of your life.
Yeah,
but people thank me because they, you know, they say I changed their life. That's the number one thing. And I didn't do it. They did it. I was reminded of that.
Let me ask a question. How much is it the message? And how much is it the delivery of the message? Because obviously you have an incredible knack for the delivery of the message. If it was some random dude sort of saying the same shit that you're saying, but has no delivery, it's not going to have the impact.
Well, that's a great question. Stanford came to me during the, you know, the middle of the pandemic, and they had two of their professors that went to my Date with Destiny seminar. It's a 5-day seminar I do once a year. They were both clinically depressed. They both left with no signs of clinical depression, got rid of their drugs. And so the guys at Stanford called and said, this is unbelievable. We've never seen like this. You know, what data do you have? And I said, well, I've got millions of clients and testimonials and stories. They said, no, but like scientific data. I said, we've never done a study. If you want to do one, I'd love to. And so what do you want to do it on? And they said depression, because obviously during the pandemic, you know, I'm sure you saw suicides went through the roof, drug overdoses went through the roof. And I said, okay, well, what are we comparing to? What do the meta studies show to traditional interventions for depression? And it's really depressing. 60% of the people who have depression who go in for drug therapy and or cognitive or some form of therapy, 60% don't improve at all. 40% improve, and the average improvement is 50%. So they're half as depressed. Now, some people get better, but it's so small. Most people stay on those SSRIs forever. And about a year and a half ago, I'm sure you saw the cover of Newsweek show that SSRIs don't even work. We know they don't work, and we still sell millions of them every single day.
I'm on them. I'm on 20 milligrams of Lexapro.
Really?
Yeah. I tried to wean off of it, and I did properly.
Yes.
And I went back into, it wasn't for depression, it was anxiety.
Heavy anxiety.
I fucking fell back in this. I was out of my mind and trying to fight through it, trying to use other methods. And then I had to get back. I had to go to work. I had to do a job. I was like, I can't function. I have to go back on, you know?
Well, as you know, there are lots of side effects to them as well that aren't so happy. And think of it this way. We don't experience life. We experience the life we focus on. So in a moment, you can create anxiety if you change your focus to certain things. In another moment, like you could be at a funeral with someone you love and everyone's crying, and then someone talks about some moment about the deceased that's funny, and you go from crying to laughing instantaneously. So you have a habit in the way you perceive the world right now that controls your quote-unquote anxiety. It's not yours, by the way. The first thing I do is I get rid of the word your, because when you do that, it becomes your identity, and it locks you hypnotically into the place. But I'll just tell you what they proved. I said, okay, what's the best study you've ever done? And you might like the best study. They did it at Johns Hopkins, and they gave people psilocybin for 30 days.
I interviewed
Matthew Johnson.
Matthew Johnson, the guy who runs...
But
a question I was going to have is how you feel about sort of these psilocybin plant medicine therapies these days and ketamine.
I'll answer that for you but that study, I'm sure you know, they did cognitive therapy and psilocybin for 30 days. And I said, well, I don't know what the result is, but you better have gotten something out of that. And you change somebody's biochemistry that much. And it was the best result they've ever seen in the history of psychiatry up until that point. 6 weeks afterwards, 54% of the people had no symptoms of depression. So it's much better than SSRIs, obviously. But it's not legal in most parts of the world, right, or the country. So nothing's really happened with it. So I said, well, why don't you use that study to compare to ours? We'll use no drugs. We'll do 5 days, not 30 days. And you can test the result. The results, guys, were so dramatic that they were afraid of being canceled before they published it. So they sent blind out to three different organizations all the data. It all came back the same. It wasn't that hard. 100% of the people 6 weeks later after the five-day program with no drugs had no version of it whatsoever of depression. Better than that, 17% of the people they put in had suicidal ideation. Zero had suicidal ideation. And then they followed up 11 months later. They're going to do 12 months, but then COVID was ending and people were going back to home and they had all these perfect statistics. So they did 11 months later. 11 months later, no depression with no interaction with me whatsoever again. Not only none of that, but their negative emotions overall were down 72%. Their positives were up 51%. And now they just did a one-year study that just ended in December on, businesses, their level of engagement has changed, obviously, since COVID. So it's about quiet quitting versus, loud quitting versus engagement. And all I know is in the first, all the numbers that they've ever had for engagement have gone through the floor, the worst in history during COVID. And in 5 days, we reversed not only all the results, but got them better than they ever were before. And for 6 months after that, it kept climbing without any further talking. So the reason that that works, to answer your question, is they took my same content. Mm-hmm. A guy from Stanford, who's one of the top professors, most popular professors, teach the exact same content. And he got pretty wonderful results for about 30 days, and then it dropped off the side. What was the difference? The difference is the things that I do would change people's biochemistry. And so there's something they've measured. They followed me for, the same group followed me for 3 years. And they had me wear this $60,000 device that measures heart rate variability and everything else. During the breaks, they take my saliva, they take, my blood and see what's happening. And they found that I have something that I do every time I'm on stage, that the same thing Tom Brady does and many other athletes they've measured. If Tom Brady was down in the fourth quarter, very much like the last Super Bowl for Kansas City, and he comes back to win, and he's only got 2 minutes to do it, how does he do it? Well, he goes into this biochemistry where his testosterone surges, peaks, which puts you in this focused place where everything is retained. If I said, where were you on 9/11? You both can tell me where you were, who you saw. Right. Where were you on 8/11? You don't know. The difference is emotion tied to information sticks with you, right? So when you have a testosterone surge, everything gets absorbed. But usually with testosterone, you also get cortisol. That's the stress hormone. But what happens to Tom and me and others like us at that peak performance is the cortisol drops through the floor. So all you have is this focus. That doesn't guarantee success, but it increases your probability 100-fold. The best part was they started then studying my audience. And then we went digital, because you can imagine, suddenly overnight, I was doing stadiums, for years of 15, 20,000 people. COVID, everything shut down. The stadiums are open. You can put 100 people in a stadium. Well, you can't do that. So then I figured we'll move to Vegas. They'll never shut Vegas. Well, they shut down Vegas. It's like, we'll do movie theaters, 10 people in a movie theater. They shut down the freaking movie theater. So I built a 25,000 square foot studio and 20 foot high LED screens, 0.67, highest resolution in the world. And I said, we're going to find a way to do this for people in their homes. So I now do them literally in every country in the world, 193 countries. I just did a seminar for 1.1 million people for 4 days. And what's amazing is they've gone to these countries and measured them, and they do the exact same. It looks like music. As I go into this state, so does the audience. And that's why 11 months later, the result is still stuck in their body, because it isn't just content. It is strategy, but it's also absorbed in their nervous system.
How much do you have to sort of, turn off your entrepreneurial brain and keep to your roots? Not to say you are not, that is your path, but obviously you are an entrepreneur and it is a business for you. And this business is crushing, from a monetary standpoint, but also changing lives. Do you ever have to sit back and try to balance those two things in your mind?
Because in the beginning, I have no business background. The beginning, it's just like I realized my ideas were going to die on my lips. I was more of an artist. It's like, this is my art, helping people in this way. And yet my art, I had to put on an art show if I wanted to see more than one person at a time. And then I had to hire people, and I wasn't good at any of those things. But I got good because it was a mission for me. But, I did it when I was near bankrupt. I did it when I do well. 2008, I didn't have like I do now in 114 companies, but I had about 14 companies at that time. And, it was brutal. I almost went bankrupt in the middle of those pieces. So, but I did it because it's my love. It's my passion. I'll do it as long as I possibly can. But I've learned to get good in business too, because I love solving problems and I love creating value in people's lives. So to me, they're not really separated. It's all about, how do you maximize the quality of life for people? in anything I do. There's no company I'm involved in that isn't something that I don't sell widgets or do things like that. It's like, you know, stem cells, for example, or AI. Right. It's the things that I think make a difference in the quality of life. And so that gives you so much energy when you're seeing that kind of impact.
That's great. Presented by 21 Seeds.
Ollie.
Yeah. So, you know, because you have a ton of friends and you throw a lot of parties.
Yeah.
You don't really. I mean, you've got your core group of friends.
I do throw a lot of parties.
You do throw a lot of parties.
I love a party.
You need a signature cocktail that's ready to go.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, it's also actually nice to have a signature cocktail that's ready to go when you don't have a bartender.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's just nice to have something in your fridge and you get home from work and you just want a drink.
This is true.
But you know why I like this brand of tequila?
Let me guess. Can I guess?
Yes.
Female founded.
Yes. I love a female founded spirit because there aren't that many of us.
I know. And 21 Seeds makes the most delicious and easiest margaritas ever. They're smooth. They're fresh. They taste amazing. And they're not too sweet.
No.
I do not like sweet.
They're not overly sweet.
Yeah. And they're infused with real juice.
Yes. I love women. I love supporting women. So.
Two sisters, one friend.
Listen, if you love tequila, add 21 Seeds infused tequila to your drink bar at home.
Enjoy responsibly. 21 Seeds, Diageo, New York, New York.
It's a fun time of year because everybody's starting to gear up. You've got spring break happening soon. You've got summer happening soon. Everybody's thinking about their vacations. My number one source for where I might even go in the world, Airbnb. I've got spring break. I'm shooting. I only have 4 days. Where am I going to go? I go on Airbnb and that usually is like, oh, there's a good house. I love that. Let's stay there. If you are someone who travels a lot or even has an empty room in your house, consider hosting on Airbnb. It's a lot easier than you might think, and it's also a great way to make some extra income. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV True Crime Podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, and now your newest book, The Holy Grail of Investing. I mean, you're tackling one thing that is on everybody's mind. I have a little bit of a theory on this, and let me know what you think about this, because I somehow feel like the digital world has got everybody thinking like, I have to be an entrepreneur. I have to be someone building something. I have to be a leader. And leaders look like this.
Yeah.
And for me, I think leadership looks so different and it has so many different faces.
I agree.
And people are chasing this concept that is not always the most reachable for certain types of people, personalities, craftsmen.
When you say look like this, you mean physically?
No, I mean in terms of the perception, like, oh, I need to run a business.
Oh, God.
Well, not everybody is built to actually run the business.
Right.
Some people are built to be the creator in the business, to be
totally.
to be a on the street salesperson. Like, some people are great salesmen, some people are great innovators.
Yeah.
But leadership has sort of lost, it's become this concept that I think is really unreachable to so many people. And I think it's causing a great amount of stress in the young children. They have this concept of significance. Like, if I don't do something significant, then what am I?
Yeah, it's social media driven, that, as you well know, and that's the biggest challenge, because people don't even project what's correct, right? They put a filter on everything, they make it better than it is. And that's why there's so much depression, especially in young girls, because on top of that, we have these stupid standards that are completely different from men versus women that are unattainable. And yet these girls then think, I'm not enough, as they see this, the more they watch this stuff. It's quite unfortunate. But I think I agree with you. As far as leadership, it comes in so many different forms. Some people are leaders intellectually. Some people are leaders emotionally. Some people are leaders in the way they structure things. And I think the illusion that it's one way, I talk about the three types of leaders, actually. There's the artist, which is really what I am, quite honestly. I learned to be an entrepreneur because I wanted my art to be reached by a very large number of people. And, you know, there was no real way to do it. There wasn't an industry for me that could just distribute. So I had to create my own distribution. But artists are people that want to do things just because they fall in love with the customer. They want to give them the best experience. They want their life is that. It's not the money. Of course, they want to earn money like anybody does. But if they have to choose money versus their integrity, there's zero question they're going for this. Then there's those that are more like a manager leader. They love to manage people and processes, and they love that, and they're great at that. And then there are people, they're all entrepreneurial, but there's people that are entrepreneurs. Entrepreneurs, pure entrepreneurs, you know, they're just in it for the result. You know, they're in it to build something and sell it. An artist doesn't, I don't ever even think of selling their company. An entrepreneur will sell their company in a heartbeat for the right price. Mm-hmm. So I'm really the artist, to be honest with you, but I became an entrepreneur in order to have the impact that I wanted to have. But I surround myself with pure entrepreneurs a lot of times because I'll overdo everything because, you know, I want to just so over-deliver. But coming to the economics, what I really think is missing in our society is we do not teach young people how to appreciate and take advantage of the American enterprise system that we have. You don't have to be a business owner. All you have to do is stop being a consumer. Mm-hmm. So I'll give you the most simplistic example. And, you know, we're all trained to be consumers. The other day I was talking to this group of young people. I was thinking, how am I going to get through to them on this? And so I said, how many of you guys have an iPhone? And I did my homework in advance. I thought about it the night before. They all raised their hand. I said, how many have more than one iPhone over the years? You've had more than one. They all raised their hand, right? All but like two kids. And I said, okay, well, I've had an iPhone since the very beginning. You guys have iPhones?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. So I bought them since the very beginning, 2007. I had the first iPhone. I just got a new one every year. Like most people have been around long enough to do that. Well, if you add it all up, well, you actually, I found the exact prices as they came out of it. I mean, it's $20,300 you would have spent on iPhones. Mm-hmm. Now, if you bought the stock of Apple, if you stop being a damn consumer and for a moment said, I'm going to be an owner, and you bought the first iPhone was $657 with change, with tax, and you bought Apple at that point, what it was $657 would get for you. And I did that all the way through to now. Mm-hmm. It's worth $206,000.
Yeah, amazing.
So it's like kids today think socialism is great. I went to the Soviet Union when I was 23 years old. I was brought over because of the firewalk. And I got to see that it is not equal at all. I was on a train going from Moscow to the far side of the country and back. And I was traveling with people and they're having caviar. And then we'd stop on the train in the city and there'd be a line a quarter of a mile long around a building, people standing in the freezing cold so they get a quart of milk and half a loaf of bread. So our world has not taught young people what's possible other than you got to look good, be the best, be the leader, you know, be an influencer. And unfortunately, that's getting exhausted. And so you see a lot of people doing the opposite, saying, you know, I'm going to quitting. I'm going to do the minimum. I don't need to hustle on the side. We've gone from one extreme to the other.
And that quiet quitting is sort of a new buzzword. I've been hearing.
Yeah, the quiet quitting.
Yeah, it's interesting. What does it mean exactly?
What is quiet quitting?
Meaning like you're quitting life, you're just fucking giving up.
Well, pretty much. But what they do is, I don't need to work so hard. I'm going to do the minimum amount of work where I don't lose my job. I'm not going to, I don't need to be so responsive to my boss. So I'm not going to quit, but I am quitting. I'm still getting pay. And there's loud quitting, which is people that are trying to destroy the company before they leave trying to find another job. And these are really terrible patterns that have come in extreme to people feeling they got to hustle every moment. And now with inflation, they're going like, I need $11,000 for the average family more per year to buy the same stuff. Mm-hmm. And so you know, what they haven't learned is how to be more productive. You know, when they asked Warren Buffett, how do you feel about inflation? Aren't you panicked? And he said, no. He said, it's not going to stay at 8% inflation. But if it did, all you got to be is 10% more productive and you're going to be fine. And he said, if you're worried about the currency and you're a great lawyer or doctor or speaker or podcaster, and we have shekels, you'll get the most shekels. It's really about adding value. Once again, the same principles we talked about.
Tony, you have 141 businesses.
No, 41.
114. Yeah.
That's
enough. That's what I was going to say. 141 is.
I've got a. I've got another one. I've got a pitch for another business.
If you recognize quiet quitting in your teams, if you recognize even loud quitters in your teams, or someone who is sort of like, maybe it may be possible that they go move in that direction, what do you do? How do you communicate?
We don't leave anything unsaid. We pull people aside and we coach them right away. And we say, listen, if this isn't the right place for you, the demands are too strong, it's okay. But if you want to go to the next level, we'd like to coach you. And we'd like to understand what your goals are and what your dreams are. The second study that's I told you about, the year-long study, was done on quiet quitting. And after 5 days, we turned it around for people from all walks of life. What they're really missing is what I call a compelling future. And like anyone can deal with a difficult today if they've got a compelling tomorrow, right? But these days, kids are taught, you know, the whole world's going to disappear in 12 years because of environmental disaster, which is total bullshit. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have to deal with the environment, but the world's not going away in 12 years. 100%. It's absurd. Oh, so I'm not going to have a child. I can't do anything. There's no future. It's not their fault. They're immersed in this every day, over and over again. Killer said, tell a lie big enough, loud enough, long enough, people will believe you. And boy, with social media and media today, we certainly do that. And we all know negativity sells for that same mental bias we talked about, right? It's like it bleeds, it leads, as in journalism, right? Why? Because the brain reacts. And by the way, if you click on,
the brain loves it.
Brain, I anger you, I get you more engaged. I click on that thing, even if the title it's clickbait, it doesn't match the article. I still get paid if you click it.
Right. So,
they're not bad people. They're just.
How many times do you click an article and it has nothing to do with what the headline was?
Well, talking to me. Insane. I can't even tell you how many times I've sat in interviews where someone just read the headline.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm like, I don't even know what you're talking about.
No, I know.
What are you talking about? They're like, well, it said in the thing. And I'm like, that has nothing to do with anything that I said in the article. Actually,
interesting. Where is your take on sort of misinformation these days, the access to misinformation, the sort of essentially you're yelling fire in a theater now as the First Amendment, that was the amendment of the First Amendment where you used free speech until that. Now it seems like the theater is social media and there you can create theaters of thousands of people to yell fire in.
The government just did that 2 days ago when they came out and said, oh, we have this huge emergency. You should be fearful, but don't panic. But we're not going to tell you what it is. And it was just not true. Right. It's something that's been going on. They've known about for years. It was just designed to scare people so that they could pass the money for Ukraine. And you might support sending money to Ukraine, but it's a really bad technique. But they found through what they did with COVID and many other things, fear controls people. If you get enough fear there. So it's extremely unfortunate. But also the problem is when you try to curtail, quote, misinformation, who makes that decision?
Right.
So now you end up with large bodies of information being controlled for their interests. So it's a difficult thing. And what we have to teach young people is how to think critically. It's not about not having, there's always been misinformation.
Always. Right. Now it's just, there's just so many avenues.
Well, hoping that we can always have access to all kinds of information as well, Yeah. You know what, Tony, we're going to break this up into two parts. Yeah,
we don't want to.
There's so much to talk about. We love talking to you.
Yeah, we don't want this to be a 3-hour episode. So we need to break it up because what you're saying is too, it's too important.
And all this financial insight is to me like, you just don't learn this in school. Younger generation aren't prepared for this. So I think this is very important. So
two-part.
Let's reconvene.
Grand Canyon University, an affordable private Christian university, is one of the largest and fastest growing universities in the country, offering more than 270 programs online. In addition to federal grants and aid, GCU's online students received nearly $130 million in institutional scholarships in 2022. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu/myoffer to see the scholarships you may qualify for.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in L.A., and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.